Building Identity. Der Architektur-Podcast der Quadriga.
Ja, herzlich willkommen, meine Damen und Herren, zur dritten Folge von Building Identity, dem Architektur-Podcast der Quadriga Hochschule. Wir haben uns letztes Mal mit einem Fotokünstler auseinandergesetzt und werden das Thema, das Verhältnis von Architektur und Kunst, heute ein bisschen fortsetzen. Und ich freue mich sehr, mit Kerstin Geers sprechen zu können, einem der beiden Gründer des belgischen Architekturbüros Office, Kerstin Geers, David von Severin. Für diejenigen, die sich nicht so viel mit Architektur beschäftigen, die belgische Architektur gilt momentan als sehr, sehr angesagt und wir haben eines der angesagtesten Büros vor uns. Ich freue mich sehr, Kerstin, dass wir uns jetzt ein bisschen über das, die Fähigkeit von Architektur, Identität zu schaffen und dabei auch in die Interaktion mit der Kunst zu treten, zu unterhalten. Also, herzlich willkommen, das Interview findet auf Englisch statt. And I want to start with a very simple question. We're still at the Finstral office and you built the exhibition design for the exhibition that Stefano showed his pictures in. But you're an architecture firm and quite a successful architecture firm. What interested you at this particular commission?
First of all, thank you, Alexander, for having me here. First of all, this show here at Finstral is an exhibition of Stefano Graziani. And Stefano Graziani is a person, a fantastic photographer, I believe. I mean, we essentially in our office work together with Stefano on the one hand and Bas Prinsen on the other hand. And Stefano is somebody with who we have been, I would say, sharing maybe 15 years of career. So we've been working together very often. We've been working together on various projects. I mean, going to starting not only with Stefano, but also with Pierpaolo, for example, San Rocco together, going to documenting architects and their different oeuvres. We have been working on a book together quite recently of Aldo Rossi, where he, in a way, took the pictures. So, but of course, also much closer to that, working on our own work, photographing our models, going together to see things. So that's in a way, how close as we have always been. At the same time, his work, which I think is a truly remarkable work, is very specific, I think, in that it arrives in kind of creating a narrative through a very limited set of pictures, which I think is quite powerful. I mean, he's a very narrative photographer, in my opinion. And we had the chance to organize a few, or to lay out, you could say, a few exhibitions of him in the past, of which perhaps most notably the one at the Prada Foundation in Milan. And I believe that when Stefano asked us, because it's him who asked us to do this specific commission here for Finstral, he asked, like, would you guys like to help me out? Would you like to design, so to speak, the exhibition? We thought it was the perfect question, because we felt there was something of a free space which we started to create in this collaboration, already perhaps apparent in Milan, which we maybe could push a bit further. I must admit, with the people at Finstral being extremely open-minded, I think towards his own work, but also towards what we would contribute to the mise-en-scène, it forced us to think. And if I can go very specific, I think at the show we did in Milan, we investigated the paravent. And the paravent as a way to hang work. I mean, the paravent different from, say, the wall and hanging just on the walls. There were very little walls, very few walls in that space. So perhaps there was a certain, I would say, pragmatism to that démarche. But then here, in this particular context of the Finstral place, we knew, A, that it's supposed to be a show which is not supposed to have one incarnation, but many. And two, the very space where now the show is organized is very big. And the work of Stefano needed something of a spatial intervention, perhaps disconnecting it from the very walls of the space, like we did with the paravent, because in a way the project travels, so the pictures travel, but also the layout travels, so you cannot make the walls of the building travel. So that was in a way a very quick and easy decision. And then I think we wanted to investigate further how this constellation of figures of wall, in a way frames, you could sense, I mean, frames made out of aluminium profiles, could become more autonomous, and not anymore just furniture, but be more ambiguous between furniture, window, and wall. And that's why I think ultimately we took that job. So we took the job simply because it was not a job, because it was a challenge. It was a challenge laid out already, because we saw the picture of Stefano early, laid out by the very pictures he took. And I was shocked, if I may say that, I was fascinated that the pictures he took of, in a way, ultimately a corporate company, that they were showing so much a deconstruction of that company. Literally so, the profiles, the way the profiles were assembled, how in the production process you would see things, but not the actual product. And we thought that we had to go together with him on that road to search.
In your text about the exhibition, you call it, he is producing a subversive image of the company almost.
Yeah, I think so, because I believe really that on the one hand, one can only praise companies like Finstral who are ready to invite people to think what they do, to think about what they do. At the same time, most often in these contexts, it's a bit of a, I would dare to say, cheap PR campaign. And I do not think that Stefano was into that. And he very quickly said, okay, sure. I mean, you ask me to do this. Let me think. In which lineage do I operate? And I mean, I think Stefano can be extremely precise about that lineage. I mean, there is a lineage of modern photography about depicting production processes. That's one thing. At the same time, there's also a lineage, let's say, post-70s, where people question, you know, the logics of, I mean, the easy capitalist machine and how, to a certain extent, these objects have, I would say, at least an ambiguous life in the world as such. And what I was very fascinated about, and as I said, we saw the pictures early, is that exactly the set, as he chose to show, in a way has at least three different layers. And this deconstructed frames, on the one hand, the collection of the family, which is interesting, and how that collection acquiring art is related to, in a way, producing frames. I mean, frames and pictures and windows and so forth. And then lastly, this set of pictures he showed of realized windows, not even from the company, but in a way the history of the window as being part of a bigger thing, even the hut of Wittgenstein imagined. So in a sense, where the story about the very object, the building, into what the window, to which the window belongs, is so much bigger than the window itself. So in a sense, showing context and with which the very window itself almost disappears. And so it's these elements, you could say, different acts of deconstruction and reconstruction, bringing them back together and showing them as such, which fascinated us, and which I believe is very much part of a kind of, let's say, a reasonable, mild and constructive, I would say, questioning of what such a company does. And we wanted, of course, to a certain extent, to be part of that and do the same.
I was reminded by your text, but also by your installation of the Kohlhaas Biennale Elements of Architecture, where he kind of questioned what are the elements of architecture and also what are windows. And your text, which appeared in the book, says on the one hand, a window is an object, but then you also say a window is a tool to see something else. Mm-hmm. So not an object. Mm-hmm. There's this ambivalence, right?
I mean, say the easy answer to your question would be a Kohlhaasian oxymoron, right? I mean, it's always both at the same time. And perhaps it's more things. I was just mentioning that I was fascinated in how Stefano could at least show 3, 4, 5 layers of what that, in a way, very tactile object, which is the window, could be. And in that sense, I agree with, in the sense, your comment here, that is that I think in architecture, if architecture wants to be successful, we should be aware of the fact that every element which we produce, which we design, and which we finally, if you're lucky, construct, is part of several narratives at the same time. And so indeed, a window in that sense is on the one hand the object, the window, and it's beautifully made or badly made, and it's composed out of different profiles which are themselves already made in one way or another. Then it's of course that frame, and it's the way you look at the world. You have the picture window as an idea. The picture window of an idea being the fixed window through which I look at a given site. You know, almost like celebrating that very view or something. At the same time, I think the window as an element, and I hope that's what we showed, and not for the first time. I mean, there's a big legacy. I mean, there's many grand pavilions who worked with similar tropes, but not only him, Dan Graham, and sadly he's of course he passed away not so long ago. But where you realize that the window is itself also an element which could only almost be an architecture on its own, so that it's not just simply a part of an architecture, but you combine them, so to speak, and they make space, they organize space, they make something specific, and I believe that's what architecture ultimately does.
You just used a very interesting term, which was the multiplicity of narratives, or different narratives at once. And that reminds me of the fact that your firm is a lot involved in building for the arts, building art centers, building museums. Because in a way, these buildings always also tell different narratives at once, the narrative of the building and the narrative told by the art within. Or even different narratives. So museums or art spaces have to tell their own story, but at the same time have to be very, very flexible. I think it's kind of the most difficult thing to build well. What attracts you with these spaces, with art spaces? Why do you like to build them so much?
We did many attempts in the last 15 years. I mean, maybe not the first 5 years of our office, because things came as they came, but now our office exists for 20 years. And say the last 15, 10 years, we were very active in trying to get these kind of commissions, that's true. Not always very successfully, I must say. We very often were second prize in competitions, which we were maybe hoping to win.
Like a fantastic Montreal project.
Yeah, like most recently the Fire Foundation, which really was a pity for us. But, I mean, essentially in each of these projects, I think this idea of frame and content is very important. So to the extent, I mean, perhaps very literally so, that is that, you know, you, on the one hand, the protagonist when you do your job as an architect is, of course, the building itself. But at the same time, the building will always, to a certain extent, be the frame of that what will be shown. So this idea, which is ultimately, I think, a metaphor for architecture in general, and I think we've been talking about that much, even very early on, and to the extent that, in a way, architecture is ultimately not much more than a perimeter where life unfolds and things change. You know, and in that sense, an art center, I think, there's two aspects to it. Often, but not always, there are places where there's still quite a big free space to experiment in architecture and to understand what architecture can be, how it can perform. And, I mean, there's a kind of open mind, you could say, of the client. Having said that, we've always done that in parallel to very different projects. I mean, projects which are, I mean, even what people would call commercial projects, but we would rather call them as technical, pragmatic projects, projects for companies or something, which we think are interesting because ultimately that's how the world is built. And the world is built very often with these buildings which nobody takes much care about because think, the budgets are too low and the clients are so-so.
Factories,
indeed. And we've been doing quite a few of them in parallel to, say, more cultural projects. And most recently now, we've been working, like say, on a satellite factory in Charleroi, in Belgium, where you see that, in a way, many tropes, many ideas which one could connect to perhaps more, I would say, spectacular commissions, more cultural commissions, are actually at play. We also very recently kind of realized a brewery in Brussels, which is essentially a pragmatic building. But these pragmatic buildings, they let a lot of freedom. Because as long as they fulfill the requirements, people give you the space to act, to design. And I think that's special. In that sense, you know, I mean, I think sometimes there, the cultural, the public, the social, which I think is ultimately the real role of architecture, no? Because you make a figure, you make a building, and you mediate between the people who use it, between the city, between you know, people who are part of it and people who would like to see and enter and can use it sometimes, and maybe for them who it's only a background aspect. And maybe learning from our cultural commissions and perhaps even things like this very small show here with Stefano, where, you know, you do experiments in looseness. For example, this experiment here is an experiment in looseness, and you see quite literally its effect in our kind of far more strict, far more pragmatic, far more economy of means, if you want, like buildings.
I think that's a very interesting thought, to learn from cultural buildings, if also when you build commercially or factories or in general spaces for companies, because I think there's kind of that we are at a crossroads as far as these buildings are concerned. On the one hand, the old idea of corporate architecture doesn't work anymore, you know, purely representative palaces, nobody wants that anymore. On the other hand, the demand is still there to create social spaces, to integrate people, and also integrate the public into your building, and also to create a sense of identity almost. I mean, the term of identity, that's why my podcast is called Building Identity, because I think it is so important. We are living in a world where we are losing a lot of identity. At the same time, people have this desire. And maybe architecture can provide an answer to that desire, right?
Well, I think, frankly, that the real question is urbanity. And in the sense that we are living in an urbanized world. I mean, I heard it on the radio this morning. I must admit, very shocked that in the last 50 years, 70% of wild animals have disappeared. That's an insane number. It's not a good number. It's a dramatic number. The consequence is that a claim which we have been making for a long time is that we live in a fully urbanized world is sadly true, which is to say that there's no wilderness. There's nothing left. I mean, which is in itself a big problem. I'm not sure if we as architects address that in the right way, if we can even address it in the right way. But what it does mean is that the context in which we operate, even if we're in a place which is seemingly not too urban, which is slightly wilder than the others, we are essentially operating in an urban world. And in that urban world, I mean, which is, you could say, if I put it radically, non-stop city realized. I mean, it's just the even covered field. Everything is everywhere, all the time. What we lack, I believe, is points of reference, is points of intimacy, is protection, is aspects which vaguely relate to how we would like to be ourselves. And so in that sense, if you talk about identity, yes, I would agree. If we talk about responsibility, I would say yes, that's very important. And if then we talk about industrial buildings or cultural buildings or any other buildings, as long as, you know, because we're always talking about the 0.0001%, where actually there's a desire to do something, I think any of these moments we have to take in all our hands to do something. And it has very little to do, in my opinion, with the architectural ego or ego of the master designer or something. It has much more to do with an urban figure, which is perhaps weird enough, ambiguous enough, not clear enough, that it represents one desire, one idea, one identity, one brand, one I don't know what, but abstract enough so that it can be, you know, shared by many. And I think that's ultimately, whether it's industrial or not so industrial, a building, that's what we have to fight for.
You mentioned already the mega factory in Charleroi. In what sense, take us a little bit through that project and maybe explain in what sense that project is typical of what you just said.
Well, the mega factory in Charleroi came to us fairly recently, where we were asked to, in a way, design a building for what is apparently now the biggest factory of satellites in Europe. And I mean, this is, in a way, you could say, this is designed for a big box, because what would you need? I mean, you just need a big box and you probably design these type of satellites. A site was given, and a site was interestingly somewhere between the smaller scale of houses and semi-houses and a couple of strange modernist slabs in Charleroi, in a way a city which is now desperately trying to reinvent its own urban identity, but is certainly quite messy. And that site Also, in this particular case, included a building, which is an office building, of which was already decided that the building should better be demolished because it was not fulfilling any ecological requirements of insulation, it was not usable anymore as an office and so forth. And then, in a way, in short, the idea was to use an enormous surface for parking, for cars, whether electric or not, so to speak, and then a box for this mega factory. I think what we understood, I mean, again, knowing that you're an architect operating in a very small bandwidth, is that first we had to salvage as much open space as we could. So we moved all the cars in the old office building, which is in a way not to be saved anymore as an office because you have to do too many transformations on its kind of exoskeleton in order to kind of fulfill current insulation requirements, but as a parking garage it works perfectly. To connect that building with a big figure, which is extremely simple because you know that you can only design two or three ideas about it, but has a kind of accessible roof and you access from the parking garage through bridge that building from its roof. So the building is a gigantic, you could say, Archwager blip as a figure. It has a few windows to its immediate context. It reorganizes the immediate urban context and it allows us to replant trees around what was, you know, supposed to be the parking and now is, of course, the parking building as a parking garage. And, I mean, these are small things, but I believe urbanistically they're powerful. And it's these type of, in a way, opportunities, because how do these projects come about? That is that somebody decides, perhaps with political help, to invest in that city and say, that's where we do the place. And many things can go wrong. First, the opportunity is a good opportunity, but then the result of such opportunity can be an urbanistic disaster. So here it is about finding that equilibrium. I think we did well. Let's see when it's built.
And I think if it goes well, it's an example of what you say, engaging with the identity of a place and taking it further, right? I mean, not tearing it down, but rather transforming it and giving the people the feeling that there's still something of the old left in new times. And at the same time, it's also a way of, I would say, without having seen it, demonstrating what environmentally conscious building can actually look like. You know, it's a symbol for that. It's not only that, but it's also representing that.
I think the question about environmental consciousness, I think, is a very important one. But it's important when we understand that it should create opportunities to think architecture and not to kind of result in easy communication. So it's not true, I think, that buildings with vertical gardens and buildings with a tremendous amount of solar panels are the most ecological buildings. We have to think in terms of DNA, we have to think in terms of typology, we have to think in terms of, indeed, reuse when it makes sense, we have to think in terms of sublimation also. For example, that parking building, formerly known as office building, will be an elegant building, will be beautiful, because you want to keep the building in what it once wanted to be, and you want to revive it that way. And, you know, it's this which I think is far more important than the current, sometimes extremely black and white and simplified rhetoric about what is environmentally friendly. I would use the word durable, because I think durability can be both typological, can be material, and can be indeed modernist, simple, maybe even temporary solutions. It's all of this.
And it's a terminology that is architectural. I've read somewhere that about your firm that you kind of don't like architectural discourse permanently, quoting other disciplines like sociology, politics, mm-hmm. or so on. You emphasize you want to be more, think more architecturally.
Well, you know, when we said this, it's almost 20 years ago now, you have to understand that we were, I think, inundated by, in a way, this new journalism in architecture, you know, where architecture was apparently not busy with architecture anymore, but all kind of phenomena, whether they were close at home or very far away. And we were very worried about that because we had the feeling that it just resulted in bad buildings. I mean, even already on paper, they were not good, they were not interesting. And there was a complete ignorance towards, in a way, architecture culture, which is, I mean, an old culture, and where we believe that the main role we have as an architect is to keep that culture alive. So for that reason also, when together with Pier Paolo, Stefano, we mentioned Andrea, Giovanni, many other people, Giovanna, Giovanna Silva, the photographer, we made this magazine San Rocco, we were very much busy with that. I mean, and it was a joint venture, but it was essentially also, in a way, a tongue-in-cheek, kind of funny, you could say, desire to revive this notion that we, doing architecture, we create things, we think things within, then say, this ancestry of architectural culture. And that was fundamental. It's maybe less fundamental today because I believe it's there, this layer. If we should keep that layer. I mean, there's now, I mean, very important questions, I mean, whether they're political or ecological, but it's an important layer.
Well, what is the state of architecture today? Is it better than 20 years ago? Less deconstructivist?
I don't know. I mean, I have the tendency to think that architecture, and even up to a point the world, which is scary to admit that, but it's always more or less good and more or less bad. I mean, I'm not a doom thinker. I think we have the tendency, and I'm not talking about architecture. I mean, I was talking about ecology before and about wild animals dying. I think that's a big issue. But if you talk about architectural culture, I think we have the tendency to idealize, say, former avant-gardes. We have the tendency to think that, you know, everybody was aware of what Van Doesburg or Gropius or Mondrian was doing in the 20s or 30s, but I don't think that was the case. We have the tendency to think that when Archigram made small booklets that everybody had them, but nobody had them, and so forth. So I think, in a sense, that weird relationship between what is a bubble of people who push things and the after effects, I think that will always be the same.
Which is a positive statement in a way.
Absolutely.
Because some people say that, you know, we don't create really great architecture anymore. Maybe we do, we just don't realize.
I think the context is changing, but there will always be intelligent people. And I see that with our students. On that level, I'm not worried. I'm not worried about the intelligence of people who want to produce.
On what level are you worried?
As I was saying, I think there's an ecological issue going on, and that's a real issue. The only thing is that I think now too quickly, too simply, it's translated into very visible, kind of media-savvy actions. And we should be careful that architecture is not victim of that. Because I do not think we are the right protagonist in that conversation.
There is one particular kind of building that I found prominently in your oeuvre, which is media buildings, buildings for media companies, almost as if this kind of building fascinates you a lot. Does it? And maybe take us through one or two of the examples at which you are building, working right now, or have recently worked on.
Well, it's interesting, you see, because we talked about industrial buildings, we talked about cultural buildings. You could say we talked about places of production, we talked about places of display in some sense. I think media buildings are a strange mixture of both. And we did not get into media buildings out of decision or design. I mean, very often as an architect, you know, there's an opportunity, there's a competition which looks interesting to join, or somebody asks you to join, and so you join a competition, you win, you lose. We ended up designing indeed 3-4, I think, media buildings. We won two, which is, I would say, a remarkable success. And so already 8 years ago, we won a competition in Switzerland, in Lausanne, for the Radio Télévision Suisse, the Swiss Radio and Television. Which is now really under construction. I mean, it's two more years to go, but it was a long process and a very fascinating process. And now more recently, I think about a year ago, a year and a half ago, we won a building for the Flemish Radio and Television, which is essentially a part of, say, the Belgian Radio and Television, because in Belgium, of course, everything is kind of balkanized in one way or another. That was interesting because it was almost a competition which came back, because we had done that competition more or less at the same time as the Swiss one, which we lost. And then, long story short, the initial winning project collapsed, and there was a new competition which we then finally won now for Brussels as well. So that's a little bit the context. But if I zoom in a bit more specifically about the buildings themselves, and the buildings, I think, share a bit DNA, but they're also different. What they share, of course, apart from the fact of being a part of our ongoing thinking about what the building type and figure is, and I think it's an important question in general for us, and it has mostly to do with what you define in architecture and what you do not define. I mean, that's true for industrial buildings, for buildings of production, but that's perhaps even more true for media buildings, because that's where media is produced, one could say. And if one, layer of production in our society is endlessly transforming, it is really media. Let's say where when we won more or less the RTS building, perhaps we could still talk in very logical terms about radio and television, and people would say, are you making a radio building or a television building or both? That distinction has completely blurred, also internally for these companies, also for RTS, for example, to the extent that they make content. And then they decide whether that content goes either on a website, on a blog, on a podcast like this one, it becomes really radio, or when it's kind of filmed, becomes even a snippet of television. So this is interesting. So that you're working for a company who's kind of, on the one hand, clear about what it does, but has no real finite decision or not a kind of a certainty about how in now 5 or 10 years it will produce that content. And that's exactly what we had to design for. So oddly enough, you enter again the realm which we love, which is that you have to fix certain things. I mean, in the RTS building, we decided to make a building which is made out of 4 big volumes, where many things can happen in a kind of contained context. You could say, sound is controlled, light is controlled, the right machines are there, and so forth. But also, I can do a meeting, I can do administration, and so forth. Contained volumes, which carry a very big plate, which we call in French there in Lausanne, the champ, the kind of the field in some sense, which is our take, you could say, on the idea of a non-stop interior, where all the other kinds of production happen. So, the editorial production, the thinking of a program, and so forth. And it's fascinating because you're, in a way, to a certain extent, you're building almost like a micro-city, where the volumes kind of organize that place and kind of make addresses and even shop windows and so forth. On that kind of first or second floor, depending on how you call it. And in that kind of hovering floor, all the rest happens influx. In some sense, the VRT building kind of learned from that, I think. And there, in a way, that flux box, this kind of cloud of hypothetical editorial production, is a very big volume of 100 by 100 meter. I mean, more compact than the RTS building in Lausanne, carried by, far more, mineral building, which is an octagon in this case, which has the bigger kind of production halls. In a way, the more traditional idea, also a much more traditional idea of how people are supposed to go, almost go to the theater. There's addresses, there's entrances, there's all these things. So this is fascinating for us because you deal again with buildings big enough to define a neighborhood, I mean, whether it is the campus in Lausanne or whether it's really the city in Brussels. But at the same time, buildings which certain things are extremely fixed, but then the way the buildings will be used in this sometimes up to 10 years of time in which they are actually built is radically changing, which I think is close to our, I would say, belief that architecture is not that functional in a sense. We say that sometimes as a provocation, that is that it's spatial, but not functional. It's not functional in the sense that a specific function is literally translated in the speciality of the building. It's rather spaces which create opportunities that certain functions can find their way to be organized.
The fascination that you have with media firms or with media went so far that you founded, you mentioned it already, an architecture magazine, San Rocco, which is kind of the cult architecture magazine. Everybody loves it, but it's no longer there. What happened?
Oh, well, I talked about it a bit before. I think San Rocco was important for all of us involved They're all very good friends, and I mean Stefano, who in a way was ultimately the reason why we're all here, has been part of it. It's in a way part of it, because I do not think we talk in the past if we talk about our group of people. Pier Paolo, I think, Tamburelli of Bauku has been extremely important also. I mean, I need two. I mean, I should name more people, but I think it's important to say it has been an important place where we felt we could say something, which then, I'm talking now, yeah, more than 10 years ago, something like that, genre, I think we launched it in 2010, if I'm not mistaken, we felt was urgent. I think we had our say, we had an amazingly, I would say, inspiring and also funny trajectory in this. There was many, many people contributing, but it felt very much also that the small circle, was very much keeping this whole thing up. And we felt we had said what we wanted to say. And that's really it. And ultimately, you also grow old in some sense. And you have to not desperately want to be young forever. And you have to also give space to other people to see other things. So we look very much forward to what the topics are and what we should start reading.
We do as well. Thank you very much, Carsten.
Thank you, Alexander.
Meine Damen und Herren, das war die dritte Folge von Building Identity, dem Architektur-Podcast der Quadriga, oder ich sollte genauer gesagt sagen, dem Architektur-Podcast des Center for Corporate Architecture and Spatial Identity an der Quadriga Hochschule, den wir nämlich gegründet haben. Auch hier nochmal die Aufforderung, folgt uns bitte auf Twitter oder auf LinkedIn oder beides neue Kanäle. Und wenn ihr Vorschläge habt für Interviewpartner, Themen, die wir adressieren sollen, schreibt mir eine Mail alexander.gutzmer@quadriga.eu. Ganz herzlichen Dank fürs Zuhören und auf bald. Ciao.
Das war Building Identity. Der Architektur-Podcast der Quadriga.